I'm Oliver North, and in this War Stories podcast, you'll learn how Dwight David Eisenhower rose from hardscrabble poverty in Kansas to command all Allied forces in the fight against Hitler during World War II. He later became our 34th president. Ike's engaging grin and calm sense of self-assurance did much to bolster troops in the field. It also helped him deal with the complicated personalities of Churchill, Patton, and Montgomery. You'll learn how he went from a poker-playing West Point cadet with disciplinary problems to a man President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Army Chief of Staff General George Marshall counted on day in and day out during a two-front war. You'll also hear from those who served Eisenhower, including Pearlie and Mickey McHugh, who worked side-by-side with Ike in World War II. Andy Goodpaster and William Ewald offer rare insight about their times during the Eisenhower presidency from 1953 to 61. And you'll meet Susan Eisenhower, whose relationship with her grandparents offers tremendous insight into Ike and Mamie as a couple. She tells how Mamie, a rich debutante from Denver, became Eisenhower's true partner in life and love. During more than 50 years of public service, Ike and Mamie helped shape the United States as we know it today, and they gave all of themselves in the process.
I'm Oliver North. This is War Stories. We're at the Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum in Abilene, Kansas. A memorial to the life and times of one of America's most extraordinary and beloved soldiers. He'd go on to serve as our 34th president. Dwight David Eisenhower has been described as a born optimist who always expected to win, whether playing poker against his West Point classmates or outmaneuvering Hitler's best generals. Meet the woman behind the man, Mamie Dowd Eisenhower. Her devotion to Ike, her perseverance in adversity earned her the respect of a nation. Stay with us for an inside look at one of the greatest heroes of World War II. He was once described as looking like he taught history instead of making it.
Eisenhower understood men. He used to say, wear the same socks your men do so you know how they feel.
He did not see how he could be an effective leader of his troops if there was one rule for him and one rule for everybody else.
I don't think Eisenhower really knew where he was born for a long time. The family never discussed Texas.
His Mennonite parents, David and Ida, hoped he'd be born a girl and in Kansas. But during a violent thunderstorm, Dwight David Eisenhower made his entry into the world in Denison, Texas, on October 14, 1890.
He was always a Kansan, referred to Abilene all the time.
David struggled to support a family of five on the $10 a week he earned as a railroad engine wiper. When Dwight was a little over a year old, the family returned to America's first cow town, Abilene, Kansas. Carlo D'Este is a historian who's written one of Eisenhower's most acclaimed biographies.
Tell me about his childhood.
He was born in poverty. He realized that if he was going to succeed in this world, he was going to have to not only work hard, but probably work harder than the next guy. His mother was the backbone of the Eisenhower family. The father was a little on the sullen side, never said much.
This is the house in which David and Ida raised their six sons. It's now part of the Eisenhower Presidential Library in Abilene, where Dan Holt is the director.
The six boys that came out of that house, just remarkable. They were very rambunctious. They fought. They argued. Ike had a great temper. When there's one story where he got so angry, he went out and beat his fists against a tree until they became bloody.
He, as a child, had a great deal of difficulty in learning to control his temper.
In Mrs. Ike, Portrait of a Marriage, Susan Eisenhower learned a lot about her grandfather from her grandmother.
He had a number of strategies for managing his temper. One of the things he did was to keep a diary. And this diary is used as a way to blow off steam.
Poverty was something that he never really got over. He knew he was not going to get an education beyond high school. And the only way that he would get a free education was to apply to West Point and the Naval Academy. What few people know is that his first appointment was to the Naval Academy. But he was too old. In those days, you couldn't be over 19 when you entered Annapolis. It was typical Ike. He had a fallback position.
What kind of student was he like at West Point?
Popular, but not terribly successful. Here is Eisenhower doing everything within his power to get himself thrown out. For example, in his senior year, he racked up over 100 demerits. He spent a lot of time, you know, marching punishment tours, you know, in the quadrangle.
He and his roommate were asked to report to their company officer in greatcoats, which is the big overcoat that they wear at West Point. So that's all they wore, just the coat, nothing under it. He got demerits once for dancing too wildly, where his partner actually showed her ankle on the dance floor.
One of the things that Eisenhower learned that wasn't in the curriculum was how to play poker.
He was such a good poker player, as a matter of fact, that this incredible Nordic skin that he had, that normally blushes quite easily for people with skin like that, he was able to play poker without ever showing any expression at all.
Those poker winnings helped support the poor cadet.
Within months of being commissioned in 1915 as an Army officer, it was almost as if he had an epiphany. He suddenly realized, you know, I'm going to have to get serious here.
Ike did get serious and graduated 61st in his class. He reported to Fort Sam Houston in Texas, where in 1916 he met and married one of Denver's wealthiest debutantes, Mamie Dowd.
Mamie always used to say to me that she thought she was pretty cute when she was young. She said the men that she might likely marry were really just lounge lizards with patent leather hair. But here's Ike Eisenhower, complete contrast to that. He was not one of these society boys. I think it was a tremendous shock when she actually married Ike and found out a little bit about Army life. Mamie gave him real pushback. If she didn't like something he said or thought he was talking nonsense, she'd just speak right up and tell him.
For Army wives, it was known as PHT, pushing hubby through. Mamie did it with gusto, but admitted that Ike needed to teach her how to cook. September 1917 marked the birth of their first son, Dowd. They nicknamed him Icky. The Eisenhower family's joy tempered Ike's disappointment that he wasn't seeing action in the First World War.
This is Ike's boyhood home. When War Stories continues, a family tragedy that haunted the Eisenhowers for the rest of their lives.
Christmas 1920. The 30-year-old Major and his vivacious 24-year-old wife, Mamie, were enjoying life at Camp Meade in Maryland. Also there, one of Ike's closest friends, whom he called Georgie. A young Colonel George Patton and his wife, Beatrice.
He and Patton sat up all hours of the night discussing tank tactics and how you use the tank in combat.
The Eisenhowers were a very popular social couple. As a matter of fact, the quarters that they lived in at any number of posts was always known as Club Eisenhower. My grandmother could play the piano very well.
And to their joy, their 3-year-old son, Icky, had been nicknamed Mascot of the Tank Corps. But suddenly, life took a cruel turn.
This wonderful little boy, age 3, was taken to the hospital with scarlet fever on Christmas Eve.
And to make matters worse, Mamie came down with pneumonia and was forbidden by doctors to visit her ailing son.
So the child died without her being able to say goodbye. I think my grandfather, who actually was holding the boy when he died, felt completely destroyed that he had been away so much and had seen so little of his son.
Does Eisenhower blame himself for the conditions under which they were living as the reason why Icky came down with scarlet fever?
No, he doesn't really blame anything. It was probably the most traumatic, crushing event of Eisenhower's life. It haunted him till the day he died.
On Icky's birthday, every September 24th, Granddad would send my grandmother yellow roses.
A year after Icky's death, the Eisenhowers headed for Panama. Ike joined the 20th Infantry Brigade at Camp Gilliard, defending and policing the Panama Canal Zone. Mamie wasn't happy.
He said to her in very stark terms, he said, I made my choice and my country comes first. and she had to reconcile herself to that.
Ike's new commander was this man, the highly regarded Brigadier General Fox Connor.
Connor tutored him in military history. He gave him books to read. They discussed world affairs, discussed leadership. I think Eisenhower developed a lot of his leadership traits from Fox Connor.
While Ike was acquiring the knowledge and skill that would serve him so well in the future, Mamie was pregnant again, this time dealing with the challenges of living in a hot, steamy jungle.
They were given quarters that had not been occupied for 10 years, and so they had to fumigate to get all of the rodents and the lizards. Insects would burrow into the bedding, and so they had to have the feet of their beds standing in kerosene.
Adding to their misery, the death of Ike remained a dark cloud that hung over the couple.
Ike, quite frankly, was no help. He figured if he used to work 12 hours a day, he would now work 18 hours a day. Anything to avoid having to grapple with this awful tragedy. And it took a toll on their marriage.
In fact, she at one point went home to Mama to actually produce the baby. My father's born in Denver. But then she wasn't in a big rush to come back to the Panama Canal Zone. And I think that was really an important turning point. And she decided she still really was married to the right person, this extraordinary man named Dwight Eisenhower. And in her later years, she'd say, don't ever go home to your mother. Stick it out.
3 months after his birth in August 1922, Mamie and baby John went back to the Panama Canal. After two tough years, the family returned to Camp Meade, where Ike was annoyed to learn the Army wanted him to coach football. Their stay was brief, and over the next few years, Ike was stationed in Kansas, Georgia, and Washington, D.C.
Well, Mamie always used to say that she kept house in everything but an igloo. 35 moves in about the same number of years. One year, they moved five times.
It was in Washington that Ike attended the prestigious Army War College. Then, in 1929, it was on to France, where he toured and analyzed European battlefields. Meanwhile, in Germany, the Nazi Party was rising to power. A month after the stock market crashed, Ike was working at the War Department, planning the mobilization of America for a future war. His work caught the eye of this man, the Army's chief of staff, General Douglas MacArthur.
He basically pulls Eisenhower out of the general staff and says, basically, you're working for me.
Yes.
As chief of staff. Was he enamored of Eisenhower's skills?
Absolutely. You know, Eisenhower was a jack of all trades. You give Ike a job, he got the job done.
But when it came to working for MacArthur, Ike found that getting the job done wasn't always easy.
His ego turned Ike off. His unwillingness to listen to advice, his insistence on only being told the good news and not the bad news. The bonus march of 1932 probably did more to sour Eisenhower on MacArthur than anything in their entire long relationship.
With the country mired in a crippling depression, nearly 20,000 World War I veterans marched on the Capitol demanding early payment of a $1,000 bonus.
Well, MacArthur's put in charge of the troops, and Eisenhower's with him when they go down there, and the thing erupts. Part of the bonus village is burned. The troops round the people up.
MacArthur sort of gloated about it, and Ike felt this was unseemly. These were his brother soldiers, and he felt that they deserved better.
Eisenhower wrote the Army's official after-action report.
He knew how to write this so that he wasn't saying MacArthur made a mistake or the police made a mistake, but here's what happened.
But Ike's sour feelings about his boss didn't stop him from traveling with MacArthur to the Philippines in 1935. President Quezon needed help building an army to defend his island nation against an increasingly threatening Japan.
And yet, when MacArthur retires and goes to the Philippines, Eisenhower goes along.
MacArthur won't take no for an answer. He says, I need you. I want you to come with me. Mamie was against it.
There was literally no army. He had to literally create an army from nothing. No money. Eisenhower would have to beg for arms and ammunition and equipment.
Eisenhower never failed to speak up when he disagreed with MacArthur. In fact, they actually had screaming matches. Eisenhower said, look, sir, if you don't like what I'm doing, why the hell don't you fire me? And yet MacArthur not only took it, But he would then try to console Eisenhower and say, well, now I calm that Dutch temper of yours down.
Eisenhower's diaries are very blunt towards MacArthur.
Actually, he has become only pathetic.
The last year, year and a half, he's there, constantly trying to get out of the Philippines.
The war clouds had already come. The Germans had invaded Poland in September of 1939. He knew World War II was coming. He was hopeful that he'd play a role in it.
The Eisenhowers finally returned to the United States at the end of 1939.
After this long, long service, he then makes lieutenant colonel.
He's about a 50-year-old lieutenant colonel with no future.
During the summer of 1941, as Ike proudly watched his son John head off to West Point, his next big break came with an assignment back at Fort Sam Houston in Texas.
Eisenhower became Third Army Chief of Staff to Lieutenant General Walter Kruger. This was the first time that Eisenhower actually started to be noticed outside of the military.
This is what got Eisenhower noticed. The Louisiana maneuvers of 1941. A massive war game in which Ike directed the tactical operations of a force of 220,000 soldiers.
Eisenhower became pretty much the spokesman for Third Army. One of the things that attracted the press to Eisenhower was his frankness. They asked him a question, he gave him an answer. So Ike gets promoted to Brigadier General. This was about the height of what he ever thought that he would be.
The surprise attack on Pearl Harbor and America's entry into World War II changes everything for Eisenhower. When we return, see how dealing with Winston Churchill, FDR, Stalin, even his old boss MacArthur, makes Ike as much a diplomat as a soldier.
War ravages Europe. When following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on 7 December, America was officially in a two-front war. Dwight D. Eisenhower was summoned to Washington by this man, the Army's chief of staff, a no-nonsense general named George Marshall.
Roosevelt totally trusted him. Marshall trusted Roosevelt. Marshall asked Eisenhower to develop a strategy for World War II. Eisenhower very carefully outlines his reasoning why it must be Germany first. And that is accepted. It's Eisenhower, basically, who sets that world strategy for World War II.
Ike figures he's destined to spend the war as a staffer in the War Department working for George Marshall.
Eisenhower discovered just how wrong he was when Marshall called him into his office in June of 42.
He says, well, Ike, I've decided who's going to England, and it's you. And that launched him.
Eisenhower's role when he goes to England is to get the American staff in line, and also then to begin our liaison work primarily with the British. This was not easy. The British felt the war was theirs, and they had already been fighting it since 39.
But Marshall had supreme confidence in Eisenhower. Though Ike had never served in combat and had little experience leading troops, he got along well with people and was a master strategist. The man responsible for coordinating several armies would have to be both a soldier and a diplomat.
Eisenhower learned a lot of his diplomatic skills in the Philippines because President Quezon could be difficult. MacArthur was difficult. When he goes to England to deal with the British command, with Churchill and later with De Gaulle and the Allies, it was child's play. I mean, he had been through these kinds of situations. That's something you don't learn in the textbooks.
He makes the acquaintance of Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister.
Within weeks.
Within weeks. And they hit it off. And Churchill didn't always hit it off with his generals. But in Eisenhower, he saw someone that not only he could work with, but somebody he trusted. He stood up to Churchill. And Churchill respected any officer, one, who would stand up to him, and number two, who knew what he was talking about.
Churchill found out that you can't maneuver Dwight Eisenhower any way you want to. That Eisenhower is going to match you stroke for stroke.
Winston Churchill and President Franklin Roosevelt decided that the first coordinated offensive by British and American forces would be Operation Torch. The plan was to invade French North Africa in November 42 and use it as a springboard for a later invasion of Southern Europe.
It was agreed that the commander of the Torch forces would be an American, and that American had to have the blessing of Winston Churchill. Well, Eisenhower's name was virtually the only one that was submitted. Churchill said, that's fine.
What lessons does Eisenhower learn?
Eisenhower basically learns what it takes to be a Supreme Commander. He's a rookie. All of a sudden now, he is in not only command of large forces, but he has generals and admirals working for him who outrank him, not only in rank, but in experience. So he has to deal with people far superior to him. He also has to deal with failure.
We were not well prepared. We didn't have the right equipment. We were not trained as well as we should have been.
We were up against veteran Italian and German troops who had been there, done that. And we got our faces rubbed in the mud. It was so humbling that at one point, Eisenhower didn't think he could cut it and was prepared to resign. He was prepared to send a telegram to Marshall, and his chief of staff said, "Ike, you can't do that." And he suppressed it.
It's decision time for Operation Overlord, the Normandy invasion, when the weather makes a tough choice even tougher. And the weight of it all falls on the shoulders of one man, Dwight David Eisenhower. That's next on War Stories.
Ike was very, very discouraged.
Was that after Kasserine Pass?
Yes. We went into North Africa believing that we were going to win the war and we were going to win it fairly quickly. And we got a very, very rude awakening.
The Desert Fox, Erwin Rommel, and his elite panzer divisions inflicted more than 6,000 American casualties. Ike was shattered.
He was not used to seeing those casualty reports.
In terms of yardage lost, it was the greatest defeat for the American Army in World War II.
And that meant the writing was on the wall for Major General Lloyd Friedendahl.
George Patton was summoned by Eisenhower to take over the American Second Corps.
By this time, Eisenhower is now senior to the guy he had admired so much, George Patton.
Very much senior.
Is that affecting their relationship?
Not so much to Eisenhower, but Patton thinks that Eisenhower has become too British, that he too much favors the other side, that the Americans aren't getting a fair shake. Eisenhower said, "This is an Allied war. It is going to be won by Allies." And he saw himself as an Allied commander. And that wasn't always a terribly popular position to take.
Back in Washington, D.C., Mamie boosted morale among Army wives.
Eisenhower was the only person of his rank who did not have his wife with him. My grandmother ran her life at the Wardman Tower, much like he ran his life in Europe. The spouses of Ike's staff actually lived in Mamie's apartment building. It really fell to Mamie to keep people buoyed up, to keep their optimism alive. When one of the wives broke down after dinner one evening and said, "Oh, Mamie, it's all right for you. Your husband, you know, is commanding operations. He's not actually out in the field," which, by the way, wasn't true for all of the war. Well, Mamie said, "Janie, war's hard, but we all have to hold up. There's not much you can do to help your husband, but there's a lot you can do to hurt him." My grandparents had another pact, and that was that during the war, they did not go out or socialize. And Mamie's position was that she would not be seen in a restaurant or go out and socialize with friends publicly as long as her husband was sending people into battle.
Anybody that met him liked him, and if he called you into the office, you better stand at attention.
At 25, Minnesota's Pearly Hargrave was proud to be in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. She met her husband, Mickey, Eisenhower's senior enlisted aide, when she was a driver for Ike in North Africa.
To Mickey, he was another father. And of course, if it made Mickey happy, it made me happy too.
Pearly and Mickey met most of the Allied generals in those tense days leading up to the Normandy invasion.
Mickey said he could always tell when the general had a bad night, because the ashtray was full of cigarette butts.
And some of the generals were nicer than others.
What was Patton like?
I thought he was a wonderful guy. He'd get in the car and he'd be cussing all the way in. He'd get out, walk a few steps, turn around and say, "I forgot I had a woman driver." He didn't forget.
Did you ever drive Montgomery?
That was a big headache, because Montgomery thought Eisenhower was not qualified for the job and made it very clear that he should have had that job.
Whenever couples are separated from one another, there's always an inevitable amount of gossip.
The November 1942 issue of Life magazine featured this story on the commanding general and this photograph of his personal staff that he called family. Driver Kay Summersby received a caption that raised eyebrows.
Pretty Irish woman who also serves as a driver. That caption is a real clue as to how that rumor might well have gotten started. If Mrs. Summersby had been an unattractive woman, I don't think there would have been any rumor at all.
People would come up and say, "What's all this about Kay Summersby? Is it true?" And Mickey's answer was, "Do you want the truth or do you just want a good story?" And they'd back off because Mickey said he put the general to bed every night. Mickey didn't go to bed until he did. And people woke him up in the morning.
The letters my grandfather wrote my grandmother during the war, very, very affectionate. And they really reflect this deep personal relationship they had.
He said, "If I'm ordering these men to their death, I need to see who's doing the ordering."
This is a picture of the four-star general meeting with members of the 101st Airborne on June 5th, 1944, just hours before the Allied invasion began on the beaches of Normandy, France.
The deception of using Patton as setting up a false headquarters up and down the British coast.
Operation Fortitude, where they created this fictitious First Army group and rubber tanks and wooden trucks.
A poker player's bluff?
I think so. The Germans were convinced that Patton was the best of the Allied combat generals. Ergo, Patton will be leading the Allied invasion.
The weather becomes an enormous factor at the last moment.
Between June 4th and June 6th, 1944, Dwight Eisenhower had to make not only the most difficult decision of his career, but a decision of historic consequences, and that was to postpone the Normandy landings. The weather was just simply too bad, but they couldn't call it off forever.
150,000 seasick troops were aboard some 7,000 Allied vessels waiting to go ashore. Suddenly, there was a break in the weather.
He goes around the room, he talks to his admirals, to his generals, but in the end, he is a very lonely man. The decision falls on his shoulders.
As the landing is proceeding, he goes back to his quarters and he writes out
a note and stuck it in his breast pocket. And the note read, "Our landings have failed. I have withdrawn the troops. If any blame occurs for this, it is mine and mine alone." His naval aide, Harry Butcher, was going to send his shirt to the laundry, and he finds this note. And thankfully for history, this was preserved.
Were people thinking this war is going to be over by Christmas?
By the autumn, the terrible weather sets in, the Hurtgen Forest, these terrible battles are fought, where we take tremendous casualties, far worse than Normandy. And the realization has come home to Eisenhower that this war will not end in 1944. Along comes this great last gasp by Hitler, the Battle of the Bulge.
It was December 16th, 1944. And it was also Pearlie and Mickey's wedding day.
Battle of the Bulge had started very early that morning, mm-hmm. Middle of the night.
Yep.
He still goes to the wedding.
He knew what was going on all the time. He was getting reports.
5 months after the wedding, two German officers marched into Eisenhower's office and surrendered what was left of the Third Reich.
He just growled at them and said, "Do you understand the terms of what you have signed? You had better understand it because I will hold you personally responsible." He signs a simple telegram saying, "Folks, the war is over."
With World War II finally over, the five-star general and Mamie retreat to private life. But President Harry Truman has other ideas. That's just ahead on War Stories.
General Dwight D. Eisenhower returned home from Europe to a hero's welcome in November 1945.
He's appointed Chief of Staff of the United States Army, something he didn't really like at all. He's looking at demobilization of the armed forces and the general run-of-the-mill things that chiefs of staff do.
It was the run-of-the-mill that finally got to Ike in 1948.
Let's face it, you've been in action like he had for all those years. This has got to be a little bit boring.
Retiring from the Army, Eisenhower became the president of New York's Columbia University. But Mamie soon discovered that their days of living under a microscope were far from over.
She got an anonymous letter from one of the wives of a faculty member suggesting that Mrs. Eisenhower get her bangs cut. And that Mamie thought that was a riot. She said, well, I'm not here to be made over.
Ike and Mamie also purchased their first and only home, a tranquil 200-acre farm in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
Eisenhower was, of course, highly interested in the Civil War, and it was a wonderful homestead. I mean, he was a gentleman farmer.
December 1950, 5 months after communist North Korea invaded democratic South Korea, the Ivy League college president was back in uniform.
President Truman selects him to be the first Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe commander. Eisenhower relished the NATO role.
There's some thinking that Truman asked Eisenhower to become Supreme Allied Commander in Europe because he was afraid of him politically. Any truth to that?
President Truman asked Eisenhower to take that post because he was the only man in the world that could pull it off.
Andrew Goodpaster, former Supreme Commander of NATO, served as staff secretary at the White House and was one of Ike's closest confidants.
He really devoted himself to the building up of this collective force. But there were people who were pressing him to run for president.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike for president.
People have been talking about running Eisenhower for president since at least 44. And this is probably the last grassroots election of a president.
He had a real shouting match with Senator Robert Taft, who was opposed to the idea of the United States being so involved in NATO. And he often said that it was that moment that caused him to go down that road.
An opening rally that gives the Eisenhower bandwagon the momentum of a comet.
Then they have the famous New York rally for him, and Jackie Cochran, has been referred to as the female Chuck Yeager, flew the film over, showed it to Eisenhower, and it moved him to tears that there's this much support.
Ike declared himself a Republican and entered the 1952 presidential election running against Democrat Adlai Stevenson.
Hang out the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington.
With Mamie at his side, the 62-year-old war hero with a warm smile campaigned tirelessly. Eisenhower also encountered one of the era's most controversial figures, Senator Joseph McCarthy, the self-appointed leader of a communist manhunt, then at the peak of his power.
They met in deepest secrecy in a hotel room in Illinois.
Dr. William Bragg Ewald was an Eisenhower speechwriter and the author of the book, Who Killed Joe McCarthy?
Eisenhower had absolutely no use whatsoever for McCarthy. He skinned McCarthy alive, just the two of them in the room.
Ike had also planned to denounce the Wisconsin senator during a speech in Milwaukee.
His staff persuaded him to take the passage out. They did not want to see Eisenhower lose the state of Wisconsin. Eisenhower hated having to do it.
After a landslide victory, America welcomed her 34th president with a first coast-to-coast televised inauguration. Ike kept his campaign promise to end the war in Korea. And on July 27, 1953, a truce was finally signed.
The so-called happy 50s were far from happy. This was a very dangerous time period. The Hungarian Revolt, we had covert actions in Guatemala. We had covert actions in Central Africa. Any of these could have, at any one time, exploded. Eisenhower was very good at keeping things from exploding.
A U-2 spy plane is shot down. The Soviets capture the pilot, Francis Gary Powers, and President Eisenhower is caught in a lie. Did it tarnish his presidency? You decide when War Stories returns.
...1953. Freddie Blassie wrestled pencil neck geeks and Chuck Yeager went Mach 2. And 8 months after nuclear tests in Nevada, Dwight Eisenhower introduced Atoms for Peace.
This greatest of destructive forces can be developed into a great boom for the benefit of all mankind.
Atoms for Peace was a shock to some people that we can have peaceful use of nuclear power. We have a whole new world out there.
He was very meticulous about having these press conferences. He said, we're not going to dance at the end of their string. We're going to present what we're doing and why.
At the White House, Andrew Goodpaster saw the president combine work and play.
He would go out and play golf, take an hour out to go out and do chip shots on the White House lawn. On occasion, he would want to sit and talk in a relaxed fashion.
She developed something called Meniere's syndrome, which is a terrible affliction. It affects the inner ear, and it disturbs your sense of balance. There was some gossip about the fact that Mamie drank too much alcohol, but anybody who knew her certainly knew well that this was something she never had a problem with.
The war years had taken their physical toll. Ike suffered his first heart attack while on vacation in Colorado. Jim Lyersoff is an archivist at the Eisenhower Library.
He suffered a heart attack shortly after midnight on September 24, 1955. When the public first heard, they were shocked. He was a hero to them, and the prospect of losing him shook them up rather badly.
Before very long, he was able to come back to rest, recuperate, up at Gettysburg, and he operated out of a small room out at the farm. And then he gradually was able to pick up his physical activity and then came down to the White House.
Despite rapid recoveries, the 66-year-old president's health problems continued. This left Vice President Richard Nixon and his wife Pat hosting some White House events.
In June 1956, he had an acute crisis of what we call Crohn's disease now. He apparently had that for all of his adult life. It was in November 1957. His speech was slurred.
I came in and I found that he was unable to speak. And I told him, Mr. President, you've got to go over to the White House, to the mansion, and go to bed.
And they decided he had a so-called little stroke that didn't seriously impair him except for perhaps a day or two.
Eisenhower was held in very special regard in the Soviet Union. He is the only foreigner who was ever invited to stand on Lenin's tomb and receive the review of the Russian armed forces. That was done in appreciation for what was done during World War II.
All that seemed forgotten as the Cold War heated up with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev.
Eisenhower had his own source of information through the U-2, which was very, very tightly controlled. A plane could give enormous amounts of information as to what the Soviets were doing and were not doing.
Francis Gary Powers. Were you aware of that particular flight? Did you brief him beforehand?
Oh, yes. Oh, well, what we did.
2 weeks before a crucial summit conference, Air Force pilot Francis Gary Powers went down in his U-2 over the Soviet Union.
I got the word from the CIA. We had a cover plan, but it was very thin. Then the next thing we knew, Khrushchev lowered the trap on us, and he showed a plane, which was not the U-2, but we also have the pilot.
There are some people who say that when President Eisenhower didn't come out and immediately say, that's our guy, that's our airplane, that it in some way diminished his presidency.
The record will show that when Eisenhower himself spoke, he laid it out. He said it's an ugly necessity to get that kind of information to protect against a surprise attack.
Open society in the day of present weapons are the only answer.
After a propaganda trial and 18 months in a Soviet prison, Powers was released.
Eisenhower said that hindsight is much more accurate than foresight, but nowhere near as valuable.
With John F. Kennedy inaugurated, the Eisenhowers looked forward to a calmer life in Gettysburg, but it didn't start out that way.
Aerial films revealed the presence on Cuban soil of offensive Russian nuclear weapons.
I was with Eisenhower during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We were working on the memoirs, but occasionally some secretary would come through the door with a note, hand it to the president, and it's the White House is calling. One time he came back in the room and said, boy, that was good. That was good news. But he didn't tell us what the good news was.
U-2 photographs show that Khrushchev had put missiles into Cuba and was lying about it.
More on the life of Dwight David Eisenhower when War Stories continues.
I think it was hard because over time it became really quite clear that he probably was never going to go home.
Susan watched her grandfather spend his last year not at the Gettysburg Farm, but at Walter Reed Army Hospital.
He died in March of 1969. And of course, seeing him go, as Mamie always said, was the hardest thing she ever did in her life.
Mamie would join her beloved husband in 1979. Together with Icky, they rest here in this place of meditation at the Eisenhower Center in Abilene, Kansas.
Ike never forgot his modest roots here in the heartland of the American Plains. His words inscribed here above where he and Mamie lie at rest affirm his modesty. Humility must always be the portion of any man who receives acclaim earned in blood of his followers and sacrifices of his friends. Dwight David Eisenhower, as soldier and president, served us well when America needed him most. His is a war story that deserves to be told. I'm Oliver North. Good night.